Welcome to the Growth Equation Podcast. We're your hosts, Brad Stahlberg
and Steve Magnus.
And we're interested in exploring the art, science, and practice of performance and well-being.
Whether on the playing field, in the office, or in the classroom, the principles of sustainable success are the same. There's a lot of noise and nonsense out there in this space. Our goal is to cut to the signal. This week, we're going to talk about leadership. Why? Because at this current time, leadership is under the microscope. We're seeing governors, presidents, leaders of countries, CEOs, all having to deal with the crisis that is the pandemic, and then the backlash or after effects of shutting down essentially the world. And it's been really interesting, Brad, seeing how different leaders from different areas have responded. You've had some CEOs forego their entire salaries, right? Some companies that are in a really good position and have a lot of money saved up to be able to take care of their workers, and others who have been in kind of panic mode. The same goes in their response to the governors and leaders of countries handling of a pandemic. Some listen to key advisors, some go off their gut and instinct. So we thought it was a good time to kind of unpack what leadership is, what the research says, and kind of see where it goes.
Yeah, it's definitely been an interesting time to sit back and watch how different individuals work through this and the different strategies. And I think it's really made clear some differences in how individuals lead. And I think something that we'll probably get into is there's not a one size fits all package for leadership, but there are a menu of guiding principles, almost, if you will, that can help you figure out what makes the most sense when to be an effective leader, both for others, and then also a topic that I'm really interested in that I hope that we'll have some time to touch on today as well, is this notion of leading yourself.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Whenever I think of leadership, of course, my mind goes to coaches and sport, right? And it's interesting when you step back and you think about it and you look at all the successful coaches, is there are a wide range. And if we define success only by games won, you have this range that includes the Bobby Knights of the world, which are almost this dictator type leader, all the way to like the player coaches of the Pete Carroll's Seattle Seahawks of the world on the other end, maybe, and all types in terms of winning games are successful. So I'm really looking forward to kind of diving into those different types, and let's just do that. So I think a good place to start is what the research says about what leadership is, and this applies not only to sport, but life in general. And I love this definition by Hammermeister, who said that leadership is the art and science of persuading others to achieve personal as well as group goals. And if you look at, a CEO in charge of a company, that's what you're trying to do, is get everyone on the same page working towards some goal. Same with the coach. But what the research kind of says is that we can divide leadership styles up into a couple different buckets, right? A couple different categories. And there's the authoritarian, the servant, and the transformational. Now, there's other styles beyond this, but I think for our sake, we'll keep it simple and address this. And before going too deep into it, I think it's worth defining what authoritarian style of leading is, because I think it's, at least in the sporting world, almost the most well known. And I mentioned earlier that the Bobby Knights of the world, the Paul Bear Bryants of the world, tend to have this authoritarian leadership. And in sport, we tend to think like, oh, this works really well, right? We need to be really tough on our athletes, be demanding, all of that good stuff. And that tends to work. right? That creates disciplined players, disciplined athletes who are going to come through in the tough times. And I'm not sure if that is true.
Yeah, it's a good point that you raise. And I think that, the answer is it depends, right? And in some instances, perhaps an authoritarian leadership type style makes sense. And in other instances, it doesn't. I think that and I believe, Steve, you know the science a little bit better than me, that it can be pretty effective for short-term goals to lead in an authoritarian manner. But in terms of long-term goals and making long-term progress, it is not as beneficial. And I almost wonder, it would be fascinating if somebody looked into this more rigorously, but if part of the reason that a coach like Bobby Knight can be successful is because he's coaching in a college environment where he's only got to worry about players for 4 years. So you can throw eggs against the wall for 4 years and a lot will break, but some won't. But once you're throwing eggs against the wall for 8 years, 10 years, 20 years, eventually they're all going to break. And break could be illness, injury, burnout, and break could also just be losing respect for the leader. And so much of the power of authoritarian leadership comes really from a human fear response. So if you lead by authority, you're basically saying that I am the leader and you need to listen to me or else. And it's that or else that leads to fear. And it could be or else you get cut from the team, or else you get fired for the organization, or else you fall out of my good graces, or else you get embarrassed publicly, you name it. And this goes to the heart of human biology. You have the stress response. And stress response is activated by fear. And when we feel fear, we're actually a lot better for a short period of time because our perceptions are heightened. We are generally thinking more quickly. And you can think way back to evolution. You know, this is when you're on the savannah and you see a predator, you get scared and it immediately locks you into the moment. And that helps you avoid the predator. So in a short term, fear is very, very adaptive and it can bring out someone's best. But if you're chronically in that state of fear and high stress, eventually what happens is your systems burn out, you become fatigued, you become apathetic, and you kind of just start to say, screw it. So maybe my take on authoritarian leadership is that it's a tool in the toolkit, and in very specific instances where you need to really motivate someone short term, there might be a place for it. But in terms of a long-term kind of leadership personality or tool, I don't think it's that effective. Certainly not for having solid relationships with your people, but perhaps not even for winning. So I'm curious to hear what you think on the whole Bobby Knight, 4 year thing. Like, are there examples of authoritarian leaders who led teams or organizations for a very long time to success?
Yeah, that's, I think that's a really good point. And I'm reminded when you say the short term eggs against the wall of Paul Bear Bryant, who coached at Alabama for a really long time, right? Famous coach, won a bunch of national titles in college football. And he's also infamous for this period of time when he took over A&M, Texas A&M, before he went to Alabama. And he had this hellish kind of camp, preseason camp in Junction, Texas. And there's been like an ESPN movie and a book about it called The Junction Boys. And he just put these players through hell. And the story is that like he put these players through such tough training that it led them to unbelievable success, right? But if you dive into it, of the 70 or so athletes who went on this camp, only I think like 25 survived or 25 made it on the team after this. And then they went 1-9 that year.
Okay.
2 years later, it was like 2 or 3 years later, they did really well and went like 9-1. But on that 9-1 team, there were only 8 players from that camp left. So the legend is like, oh, we need to be extremely tough authoritarian. But if you dig into it, it's like, yes, those 8 players are there. But what happened is they started getting better talent, you know, and they got better recruiting, partly, you know, not to disparage because this was the times, but partly they also paid for athletes to come there. So they got better talent, you know, better athletes, and they perform better. And, you know, I think when we think about the college scene a lot, I think you're right in the sense that so much of it is like the talent you can get through the recruiting side and then capitalizing that on that in a very, very short window. And then you're gone. And another thing I'd say is the research shows that there was a study a couple years ago that looked at speeches of coaches, right? And they tracked all these high school and college speeches where the researchers came in and they had like 300 halftime speeches or pregame speeches and stuff. And what they found is that occasional, like pretty anger authoritarian speeches work, right? But if you go too far into what the researchers actually said, the Bobby Knight territory, it backfires, right? People get used to the anger. They stop responding to it. It becomes noise. And I think that's why you probably see these kind of authoritarian coaches work at the college level, like you said, where it's like, oh, we only have this short period of time and they can get over it. And then the last study that I'll point out here is there was this study out of Queen's University a couple years ago that tracked authoritarian style coaches in the NBA. So they went back, looked at all the games, looked at the reports of how the coaches interact with players and could classify them by like how many outbursts the coaches had and all that stuff. And they classified these coaches over, it was something like a decade long period of NBA games. And then they tracked how their players performed, not only while they were the coach there, but in their careers. And they found, you know, maybe not surprisingly, that after being exposed to a coach who used this authoritarian or abusive style, the player's likelihood or the player's number of technicals went up, right? So technicals, fouls are like, they used it as a surrogate measure of aggressiveness, right? The more aggressive you are, the more technical fouls you'll likely get. So throughout their career, they went up, even after that coach left. And then they also tied it to performance of athletes, of these athletes who experienced authoritarian coach declined more over their peers who didn't. So, you know, they titled this this study Scarred for the Rest of My Career. And I think there's like probably, you know, that research shows that there's some truth to your theory that, you know, it might work really well in the college level because you got 4 years. But at the NBA or NFL or, you know, in outside of sport in a company where you're going to work even longer there, right, that fear, like you become adapted to it and then you respond negatively to it and then you might lose talent because you look for better places.
And I think that I can speak a little bit to outside of sport. I think that an authoritarian leadership style has the potential to work really well and well purely by wins and losses. I'm not necessarily saying by, like, you know, having people like you and having people feel good, but it works really well in industries or organizations where parts are parts. And what I mean by that is if a part breaks, you just replace it with the next part. And two examples of this that come to mind immediately are the military and medical school. So in the military and in medical school, you've got lots and lots of people all striving for the same goal. And the military has a huge supply of candidates. And at each level of progress in the military, there are more people than there are for roles. And the medical school acceptance rate is only like 50%. So there's an endless supply of parts. And in those two instances, authoritarian leadership styles really predominate. They're both very paternalistic, very hierarchical, and very driven by authority. And what you get is lots of burnout, lots of people failing, and they fail and they're just replaced by a new part. Now, the dark side of that is, in addition to burnout, if you look at rates of suicide, the military and medical school are two of the top, if not the two top, kind of organizational bubbles where you have lots of deaths by suicide. Now, obviously, there are all kinds of other factors. What you're seeing as a young physician or a physician in training and what you're seeing in the military is very different than what you're seeing in other fields. So I'm not going to say it's because of the authoritarian leadership. I don't think that's the case. But I do wonder if it doesn't contribute in a way to not feeling supported, not feeling internally whole. And it could be one small element of some of those very dire outcomes. Because if you're constantly doing something to avoid being punished or to avoid failing or to avoid being made fun of, you're operating from this place of insecurity. And once that authoritarian figure is gone, then it's like, well, what's the point of showing up? It's almost like, you lose your internal motivation altogether because you're so driven by not being punished.
You know, I think you got a major key there, which is mistaking sorting for development.
Yeah, that's the eggs against the wall thing, right?
Right, because it's like the military, if you look at it, there's a sorting component to it, right? Who makes the Navy SEALs? Like, all that challenging stuff isn't to develop Navy SEALs. In terms of like hell weeks and stuff, is to sort who can survive this, and then they'll worry about development once they understand like who can handle this, right? And I think in medical school, to a degree, it's the same. It's sorting. Oh, totally.
It's pure sorting.
You know, who can handle this, and like then we'll worry about developing your abilities after that, to a degree. And I think that's one of these major things where we mistake this sorting for development. And that's one of the reasons why I think this kind of authoritarian style might stick around. And, you know, there was another research paper that I read that kind of asked, okay, why do people tend to use this style, especially in sports, but also military and medical schools and other areas, and even CEOs? And Lombardo et al. In 1987 said that they thought it was the dominant form of leadership in athletics, as it does have its advantages in that it is quick and it does not require a sophisticated knowledge of the followers, meaning the people. You don't have to take the time to know the people and understand who you're trying to lead, because there is, as you said, an endless supply of individuals who can come in and replace and do that job.
I think one other thing worth adding before perhaps we move on to another style is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. We're not going to sit here and be the Brad and Steve woo-woo show, although maybe that is what we are. There is probably a time and a place to use an authoritarian lens, and it's probably best couched in some of these other leadership styles at certain points in time. And what comes to mind for me as an example is just being a parent. So I've got a really young kid, and there are certain times when I am the authoritarian. And they tend to be times when the stakes are high and when my young son just can't understand. So an example of that is, like, we don't cross the street unless we're holding hands. And you break that rule, that's one of the few times I'm going to come close to raising my voice, and I'm going to say, no, you need to hold my hand, safety first. I'm not even trying to explain to him why, because he's two. He's not going to be able to understand it. What I need to do in that moment is put a little bit of fear in him so he holds my hand, and then he's safe. Over time, as his brain grows and he develops, of course it's going to shift. It's going to be, you look both ways, here's why. And, you know, to get back to what we were saying earlier, ultimately what that's doing is it's shifting his decision-making from purely external, don't piss dad off, to internal, my life has value, I don't want to get hit by a car.
So, you know, you make two things come to mind when you give that example. Is one, there's this wonderful article on Greg Popovich, the coach of the San Antonio Spurs, on the pillars of Popovich, where one of the pillars that they say he has, or they assign to him, is unleash your anger strategically. And it talks about how Popovich can unload during games on other players, on refs, whatever. But it says Popovich's flashes of anger are genuine and genuinely unpleasant, but also under his control. One of his players went on to say, if he gets thrown out of a game, he did this because he thought it would help his team. He never allows his upset to stop his thinking. And I think that is the key there. It's not to say don't become like authoritarian or yell or scream at or raise your voice, whatever you want to call it. At some point, it can be a tool in the toolbox. And in fact, some of the research actually points this out in the sense that brief bouts of this style work well as long as when you're using it, the people on the other end know that you have their best interests at heart, right? They know that you care about who they are, and it's not just done as this like a punishment style. And then the last thing, which, you know, you mentioned there that I think is worth maybe diving into before we get into other styles is this, what are you internalizing, right? So, like, I think that's the biggest key in any of this leadership thing is, like, what is the person you're leading internalizing when you use a style or use a method to get them to perform a task or be motivated, right? Mm-hmm. Is it intrinsic or extrinsic? And the thing that comes to mind when I think of this is, if you've seen the, not to pick on strength coaches, but I will for a little bit, but if you've seen the strength coach who gets in the face of the athlete who is like yelling and screaming at him to perform this last like 100 meter sprint or this last lift or whatever, and like really getting on them, like to me that internalizes for that athlete, oh, I am performing, I am pushing through because this other person is yelling at me, right? And like, what is he or she going to do when that person is not there, right? That, and that motivation source is gone. And I think that example you gave with your young child, Brad, is like, you want him to internalize it. I don't cross the street because it is protecting my life, you know?
Eventually. Yeah. But he's not ready to do it yet. Right. So you got, so like, again, that gets back to the short-term fear. What I, you know, need is to instill a little bit of fear in him so he listens and doesn't get crushed by a car now. But as that changes over time, it will shift for sure. And I think, like, again, you know, parenting, because I know we have a lot of parents that listen to this show, this is a really close cousin to this notion of like helicopter parenting, authoritarian leadership, that is. Whereas if the only reason your kid is doing something is out of fear or to please you or because you're like in their face about it, then once you get out of their face about it, or once that kid moves out of the house, they might not have the internal like rudder to push themselves because they're so used to pushing to please. And again, it gets back to this short-term, long-term dichotomy. If you're only coaching someone for 4 years or managing someone for a little while, or if parts are parts, and if you break someone, it's not a big deal, but you hire the next person who's similarly skilled, then authoritarian leadership is just fine if your goal is to win. But in parenting, you're stuck with that person your whole life. Unless you're popping babies out and you're emotionally just ruthless, parts are not parts. So it's probably not a great style, in terms of parenting. And I think that we see this over and over again with, I guess now in vogue, the word is helicopter parenting, where the parents that are really like almost living vicariously through their kids and pushing their kids to do things that they want them to do and doing it from a place of fear, those kids tend to end up with long-term psychological problems.
Yeah, you know, and it's not that I know this research that well, because I am not a parent, but there's also this leadership style can be tied right into the research on parenting styles, right? There's this four model parenting style research that is basically you have permissive, uninvolved, authoritative, and authoritarian. And it basically depends on like your responsiveness and I'm going to screw this up, but it's like your responsiveness versus your like control, I think is what it is. And so you can either have like low control or demanding, or you can have high responsive, or low responsive, right? And depending on those different, you know, where you fall on that gives you these different kind of parenting styles. And what's interesting is you can be really demanding, right? You can be very tough, or we'll say tough on your child and demand a lot of them if your responsiveness is high, right? If you like have this like, I don't know, you know that your child knows that you're going to be there for them, right? Then you can be be demanding. And I think when I look at that at the leadership style, I see the same thing. Is it's like you can be really tough on someone in a short term if they know that like push comes to shove, you're not going to abandon them, right? You're not going to get fired, you're not going to get cut from the team, or you're not going to do whatever. So I think it's like it's like sometimes we get in this idea of like this is good and this is a bad style, but the reality is they're all different tools that you can use at different times. And then the like knowledge that like you're going to be there as the leader, even if someone screws up, can go a long way towards like allowing you to use some of this like demanding style when you need to.
Yep, 100%. And I see that like in how I think about parenting. Certainly when I've worked with large organizations, it's very much the same is not, and I sound like a broken record, but not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So not completely saying I'm never going to move into that authoritarian lens. It's a tool in the toolkit. There might be a place for it, but it's only effective in a long-term relationship if it is couched in the greater space of love, caring, and used in conjunction with, and perhaps even in a minority of circumstances with other leadership styles. So let's use that to shift to the next leadership style. I know you mentioned the big three, authoritarian, servant, and transformational. So why don't we touch on servant leadership for a bit?
Sure. And, you know, to define that real quick, it's basically, you know, in the word itself, is that your goal is not to be the authority, the dictator or whatever. Your goal is to serve whoever it is that you're leading. So it shifts this model and puts you, instead of at the top, it almost puts you at the ground floor trying to boost up those that that you're in charge of. It's almost the opposite if we're looking at these two styles on a spectrum here. And it's interesting because again, a lot of times when we look at servant leaders, we tend to think, oh, they might be like weak, right? They might lose power. But what we're saying here is they're deriving their power from the individuals they're leading, right? They're not taking the power and saying, this is my title, I am going to lead. They realize that power is given to them from the people they're leading. So like they use that judiciously. And again, not to go too far into it, but the research on servant leadership is pretty good. From an athletic standpoint, there's been several studies that show that athletes have higher satisfaction, improved coping skills, improved performance, have better like intrinsic drive. It's not the be all end all, but over the long haul, which is something that we've talked about a lot, it looks like you're looking at not only performance metrics, but you're looking at more of these well-being metrics, which definitely improve when under servant leadership.
So I want to get into the nitty-gritty here, because this is a kumbaya woo-woo term to me. And I get that the research shows that it's really effective, but let's flesh out why and how so listeners can understand. Because on its face, if you're just, you know, again, by definition, it's a privilege to serve people. well, then you're just going to be standing there patting people on the back all the time and telling them they're doing a great job. Servant leaders still have to terminate people. Servant leaders still have to put people on performance reviews. Servant leaders still have to motivate their staffs or their athletes sometimes. So it's not saying that everything is fine. I think that more so it is creating like I use this word, creating a broad space where everything is fine. So then you can be a hard ass within that space when you need to. And I always come back to the three pillars of what social scientists call self-determination theory, which is a broad-based theory that says that for humans to feel good and thrive, they need really just three core components: autonomy, or the ability to have some control over what they're doing; mastery, or the feeling of making progress that they can trace back to themselves; and relatedness or belonging, which is feeling like you are part of a community, a tribe, a movement, or even a lineage of thinking. So just feeling like you're integrated into something larger than yourself. And to me, servant leadership is setting up a space where those three things are present. And if those three things are present, then you can be more hands-off, but it also gives you the ability to be really hands-on when you need to, because as you mentioned earlier, Steve, people feel cared for. Excuse me, people feel cared for.
Yeah, you know, I think if we get to the basics of it, it's that that self-determination theory, that filling your basic needs, which defines
the answer to everything.
Yeah, defines like everything. It's good leadership, right? Because if people feel like they belong, then it's like then you have more leeway to try these different tools. And I think the other aspect of it is this, is that we tend to think of servant leadership as like this woo-woo thing like that, like you mentioned, Brad. But like, to me, it just means that instead of thinking of it as like, oh, my role is to serve these people, we should see it as like, no, you see the people you lead as like human beings that have needs that we need to fill. And if we fill them, then that allows us to lead in a better way, right? And sometimes leading in a better way means like doing difficult things, like firing people or, you know, getting on to someone pretty deeply, you know? So it's like this filling these needs that matter. And again, not to always go back to the research, but like it shows, like if you look at the research of like utilizing power, right? People will respond to the use of power to get things done, depending on where that position of power comes from, right? If they think it comes from like being assigned things, then they will generally react negatively. If they think that power comes from like doing the best for the group as a whole, then even if that power is utilized to fire people or make tough decisions, people will accept it and understand it to a better degree, right? So it's more effective. So I think there again, it gets to like, if you treat people like human beings and fill their basic needs, then like you can do difficult things. It's when we don't, that like regardless of the leadership style we use, that we lose out. You can use a quote unquote servant leadership style and not really give a shit about the people you're working with, and it's going to fail miserably.
Yeah. So I think, you know, for me, the servant leadership style is perhaps making sure that you give, like you fulfill those people's basic needs, or you set up organizations where people have a fair degree of autonomy, where people are on a path of mastery in their own role, or in when people feel like they belong to the organization or they belong to the culture that they are working in. I think that two people that come to mind in the popular culture that do a really good job of this, Steve Kerr and Phil Jackson. Yep. And not surprising that it's those two, because Steve Kerr played for Phil Jackson. Both of them have coached teams with lots of high-powered stars. And they did not try to be authoritarian. They did not try to come in and just tell everyone what to do and lead by fear. They actually did almost the hard opposite, which is they stepped back and they really let the players grow into the best version of themselves and the best version of the team by providing them with autonomy, by having individual players on development plans. Always, there's the mastery element. And then by creating a sense of belonging. Phil Jackson was known to do like loving kindness meditation practice with the Chicago Bulls. Steve Kerr, very, very similar, has all kinds of team meetings, meditation, like a real close community just outside of the sport and super involved in the Bay Area as well. So the athletes feel like it's not just the team, but the community that they're a part of. And then it makes it easy for those guys to coach. The other thing that comes to mind is a nice little heuristic that I like to use with my executive coaching clients is leading from the back of the room. So to me, servant leadership is all about being able to lead from the back of the room. And that means exactly what you think it does. It means being able to step back and just kind of watch. And because you've set up an organization where individuals have autonomy, mastery, and belonging, you don't really have to do much. You know, every once in a while, you lean in here, you lean in there, you help people see what they don't see, but you're not up there giving a crazy speech. You're actually, you know, just kind of like the proud parent in the back of the room that intervenes when needed.
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good way to understand it.
That's how Steve coaches for everyone, by the way. I had the chance to be in the stands in one of Steve's track meets. It was a little while ago. Was it like the Stanford Invitational or is it Berkeley? Somewhere out here in California. And Steve just like sits there and smiles and every once in a while will like lean in and say something and then sits back and smiles and his teams perform really well. So kudos to you, Steve. I think you embrace this style.
Thanks. I appreciate that. But you know, it actually comes back, you know, in a coaching sense, this ties into and a leading sense, it ties into our previous podcast of like feeling the need to do something. Because a lot of times, like when you're leading or you're coaching, you feel this need to intervene, right? You're like, oh my gosh, I need to say something here. I need to like be on top of this or correct this person here. And it's really difficult to like sit back and not do that, right?
Yeah.
And I think especially in the coaching sense, but I see this even, you know, in other areas,
parenting, organizations, right. Meeting to have meetings. If you guys haven't listened, last week's podcast is by far the most popular in the short life of this podcast. And as Steve said, like perhaps the title says it all, doing stuff for the sake of doing stuff is not adding value. And a lot of times we do stuff because we're insecure and we think that, oh, if we do something, you know, that'll like numb or distract ourselves or it'll make us feel like we're contributing. This is such a syndrome in middle managers.
Yeah.
They feel like they have to prove their worth. So they just start doing stuff. And all that does is piss people off, slow down the organization. They tend to burn out pretty quickly. And you know, I'm not an organizational consultant, at least not anymore. So some organizations, there's probably room to cut those middle managers. Other organizations, there's probably room to use them differently. But I think, you know, in some organizations, they should stay there. It's just that the training for a middle manager should be servant leadership. Lead from the back of the room, see what your people don't see, and have the confidence to just like read a freaking book in your office instead of calling four meetings for the sake of calling four meetings.
I couldn't have said it better. I think that micromanaging and that need to do something gets in our way. And, you know, you talked earlier about Steve Kerr. One of my favorite examples of how he kind of gets away from this is I remember that there was a game where he just didn't coach. He handed over the whiteboard to his players and had them draw up the plays during the game, right? And what is that but an example of how to give autonomy to like the people you're leading, right? And when we do this kind of micromanage middle manager thing, what happens is we take that autonomy away a lot of times. So, you know, that's where I think as a coach is like you have to resist this feeling or this need to do something and sometimes step back and interject when it is meaningful and it is actionable, you know. And the other thing that I think, you know, if I think of my coaching career and lessons that I've taken away, is also being accountable and not hiding from something. So in the coaching world, it's really easy, because like, you get to see who performs well and who doesn't, right? And I've had coaches in my career, I've had friends, or I've known other coaches who will deflect blame at all cost and put it all on the athlete, right? And from early on, like, I realized that this was a big problem, and that I needed to accept my part of the blame, whatever it is, right? And it can't, you know, when you're looking at leading in this sense, like, it's almost like a partnership, and you get to see the results pretty quickly. And like, everybody has to take responsibility in that partnership. That doesn't mean that I should be like, oh, it's all on me if it's not, and like, alleviate the athlete from that. But it means that I should take some ownership of it. The athlete should take some ownership of it, depending on what happened. And that way we have somewhere to go and grow, instead of me putting it all on them and saying, oh, it's your fault, like, you figure it out.
Love it. Should we move on to transformational leadership? This is the style that I know the least about, Steve. When we were emailing back and forth on how to structure this conversation, you mentioned transformational leadership, and it's something that I've heard of, but I always thought it was just a buzzword. But apparently there's more to it. So what is transformational leadership? Enlighten me and everyone else.
Sure, I am not the expert on this, but what the research basically says, I guess, is the best way to look at this is transformational leadership is what I would call the Tony Robbins style of leading, right? Where your focus is mostly on how to inspire those who are following, all right, those who you're leading, is like, create inspiration and then try to use that inspiration to change whatever, you know, behavior or whatever, you know, you're trying to do. And what the research says on this is that from a motivational standpoint, like, it works okay in the short term, right? But in the long term, like, that just like using fear, using only like this inspiration, and then also trying to transform and make rapid change and growth in this, doesn't always translate over the long haul, because you're inspiring to try and motivate, and then you're trying to make rapid change, which is also somewhat uncomfortable or disconcerting. So that can like backfire over the long haul, if that kind of makes sense.
I can see where we're going with this. And in it's what I like about the podcast form. I know we're still new to this, but it really gives us the chance to get some nuance here. And what I'm hearing is that transformational leadership is almost the opposite or the reverse of authoritarian leadership. And it just seems like where we're going is that it's not either or. I guess there's three. So as my grammarian wife would correct me, it's among the three. You don't just pick one. All three of these leadership styles have a place, and perhaps that they're best when they work in concert with each other. And maybe where I'm coming out is maybe this notion of servant leadership, autonomy, belonging, mastery, is the like the base or the reference, and then you lean in with this transformational speech, rah-rah inspiration at times. You lean in with more of an authoritarian, fear-based message at times, and then you pull back, and what you're pulling back into is that space that you created by being a servant leader.
I think you nailed that one.
I love nailing things. yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's much more to say on servant leadership other than that. And I think that, again, like, it at times it does make sense to be inspirational and to give that inspirational speech, but that is it's like sugar and candy. And if you're running your engine on sugar and candy, like, it just doesn't work for the long haul.
The only thing I'd add here is that, again, like, this is why it's fun to have these conversations, because we can really get across the nuance, is the nuance matters here, right? If you're being this inspirational, transformational leader, right, and you're doing so for the sake of the organization and not the sake of, let's say, the followers' well-being, right, people can pick that up. And it doesn't work as well. You don't get this boost in confidence or motivation or whatever have you. So again, like, the foundation behind it of caring, belonging, autonomy, mastery, all these things on self-determination theory even matter in this regard as well. Because if you're just, and we've all been there, right? We've
totally.
All
it's like the mouthpiece, I call it, for the organization.
Exactly. You know, we've all been there where it's, you have that person who's the rah-rah person who comes in, like, gives the big speech, and you look in the audience and, like, eyes are rolling and all this stuff because they've been here before. They know that they're doing this not because it helps them in the audience, but because it, like, makes the organization look good, or it's about the organization and not them. So I think this is where, just like you mentioned on this, like, don't inspire, don't use this transformational style, or don't use fear, or don't use, like, yelling occasionally or raising your voice. It's like, no, those are tools in your toolbox. But when you use them, they have to have this foundation behind them. And then you have to use them strategically to get the point across. And, you know, the people you're trying to change with these styles or lead with these styles have to realize that when push comes to shove, like, they're cared about, they feel like they belong, and all their kind of basic needs are met.
I'm going to make an attempt to tie this back to something that I said way at the opening, which is not just a conversation about how to lead others, but how to lead yourself. And I think that everything that Steve just said and that we've been saying more broadly can be layered on to just that. So if you have a foundation in your own life of autonomy, mastery, and belonging, then you can lean in at certain times with the authoritarian style, the fear style, that you need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps, you need to get going, you're underperforming. You can also lean in at times and pick yourself up with the transformational style, the reading inspirational quotes, the positive self-talk, the self-compassion in love, and everything's going to be okay. You can do this. But you need that base of autonomy, mastery, and belonging. So no different than a good organization needing those three things, I challenge listeners to say, hey, how can you shape your life to have elements of those three things met? So how can you make sure that you have control over things that matter to you? How can you make sure that certain pursuits in your life, you are on a path of progress and improvement in something, and you can trace those actions back to yourself? And how can you make sure that you belong to a community? And if you have those three things, you can be hard on yourselves at times, and you can be transformational with yourself at times. If those three things are missing, being hard on yourself is just going to put you deeper in whatever hole you're in. And this notion of positive self-talk is like a Band-Aid, and you can't put a Band-Aid over a deep wound. So I really think that this is a pretty direct corollary to how you lead yourself.
Yeah, I think so. You know, it's funny. The more topics we cover on this thing, the more you realize that a lot of it comes down to, like, filling your basic psychological needs, you know? And if you do that, then you have the capacity to use these tools. And if you don't have those needs filled, both on an individual and group basis, then, like, you can't sugarcoat it. You can't use these tools. You can't use these inspirational messages or whatever have you, or, you know, get upset at yourself when you don't, you know, finish a project or go out and exercise. Because, like, you can't kind of BS yourself, you know?
Yeah. And it's, and it's harder to develop those basic needs. certainly if you're leading an organization, and I'd say even for yourself, because for yourself, you're talking about building an intentional life. For an organization, you're talking about building an organization where everyone has autonomy, mastery, and belonging. That's really hard work. It's a lot easier to get up there and yell, whether you're yelling negatively or yelling positively. It takes a lot more effort and skill and thoughtfulness and time to develop the servant leadership style of autonomy, mastery, and belonging. And same thing with your life. Like, it's a lot easier to read self-help books than to actually make changes so those basic needs are met. And it's a lot easier to yell at yourself and be hard on yourself than to, again, make the changes so that those basic needs are met.
You know, I'm going to tie this to something we talk about all the time in the growth equation, which is I think that, like, the yelling or motivating yourself through that style or inspirational messages or reading self-help is the hack way to do things, right? It's just like we're using the short-term hack because, like, it feels like we're doing something. It feels like we're making progress, and we might make a little bit, but, like, the long-term thing is, like, doing the hard work to fill your needs. And it's a much more difficult task, but it's playing the long game, you know. And if we can play the long game, then over the long haul, we're going to be better. And I think you nailed it there. And then to come back to something that we mentioned previously, is most of the time we lead, or the research showed that, like, a lot of times people choose the leadership style of, let's say, authoritarian, because it is the quick fix one, right? Because it feels like you're doing something, because it doesn't take, like, this deep understanding of everyone you're leading and how to change them and how to change their worldview. It takes one style, which is, like, extreme discipline or demandingness to get things done.
Love it. So should we wrap our conversation of leadership there and turn to what I learned from our good friend Andy Slavitz in the Bubble podcast, what they call segment 3 in the podcasting world, which is where we shift gears for a few minutes. I don't know where we're going to shift, so let's make this up as we go. Have you been watching the Last Dance, the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls documentary? Have you got a chance to see that yet?
I have not yet.
Oh, man. All right. Well, then I will talk about it for a minute. So it is a, if you guys are unfamiliar, it's either on ESPN or HBO. I think it's on ESPN. I'm almost certain. And it's a 10-hour, 10-part documentary on Michael Jordan's career told through the lens of the 1997-1998 Bulls season, which Phil Jackson labeled the Last Dance. And whether you are a basketball fan, a sports fan, or have zero interest in basketball or sports, I highly recommend it. They're airing 2 episodes at once, and the first 2 episodes were just drop dead good and really like a human drama more so than anything, with very unique and interesting characters. I think that what stood out to me most from the first 2 episodes is how, as great as MJ was, Michael Jordan, probably the best athlete in history, he probably couldn't have done it without the team around him. And I was young. I can vaguely remember Jordan, but it was always Jordan, Jordan, Jordan. But just realizing how good some of these quote-unquote role players were was fascinating.
Yeah, you know, it's the ultimate team game. I think it shows I haven't watched the documentary, but I remember the Jordan years as a Houston Rockets fan who would lose and not make it and only won their championships when Jordan left. I remember those years well. Is that it's interesting. Like, we focus on Jordan a lot, but it's like, the role players around him and even the coaching staff around them to get everyone to buy into this is one of those messages that I think is great for leadership, it also transforms. And it's interesting because I think people forget how freaking hard it is to win championships, even if you have the best player in the league. I mean, we've seen that with LeBron James. Earlier, we saw that with Kobe Bryant, right? And it's like, it's not as easy as like, oh, we have the best guy, let's go get it done. You have to have that team dynamic around to make it work.
That was another thing you mentioned, Kobe, that I remember thinking from the first few episodes is, and obviously Kobe is top of mind still for a lot of people, is his sudden and tragic passing and that of his daughter, Gigi. But man, watching this documentary, I kept on thinking, am I watching MJ or is that Kobe? Not just the way they played, but the way they carried themselves, the way that their teammates viewed them. It was really, really neat to see just how much Kobe came from like the Michael Jordan mold and the Michael Jordan lineage. And even seeing pieces of LeBron in that. So again, I highly recommend it. Even if you're not a fan of sport, it's just it's been a phenomenally put together study of very interesting human characters. All right. So one more segment three shift. Tell me about your interesting quarantine workouts, Steve. What have you been up to?
You always ask this question and all I do is run. And my 25 pushups. Okay. I have done 25 pushups every day. That is my
bulk. You're breaking that up into what? 12 sets of two?
No, man, 25 straight. I knock it out and I'm done.
Show notes. I want to see a video.
Oh, okay. We'll do it. They won't be pretty push-ups, but they will be 25 in a row. This is my mental strength and toughness that come through here. Let's see what else. You know, I mean, it's basically I just go for runs. So I'm at my highest mileage for like the past, like, I don't know, 5 years, because I just go out and run every day. And it's nice, you know, it's enjoyable. No workout, just running, me and my fiance and our dog. So that's
how's it. Your fiance's arm doing? I know she broke her collarbone a little while ago.
Yeah, it's good. It's healing. It's collarbones are kind of crazy. It's like you see, the x-ray looks gnarly and like it would never heal, but somehow it's supposed to heal. So our mileage is determined by when her collarbone starts to hurt because of like not from the bone itself, but because of the movement. So that's how we've determined things. And then our dog, how far he makes it, totally dependent on the weather. If it's 75 and humid, he makes it 2.75. If it's 50 degrees, then he makes it 5 or 6 miles. So
that makes sense. You know, in all seriousness, something that I threw out into the Twitter machine yesterday that I was really glad to see take off is just the importance of exercise during this period of time where a lot of people are homebound, people are experiencing challenging emotions, all the way from despair and sadness to maybe less extreme emotions like restlessness. Move your body, move your body, move your body. There's such overwhelming evidence that by far, tied with sleep, the number one thing that is within your control and most people have easy access to that can help affect your mood is some sort of physical activity. And when we say exercise, it doesn't mean running necessarily, though it can. It doesn't mean push-ups, squats. It can mean gardening. It can mean a fast-paced walk. It can mean walking up and down the stairs if you live in an apartment building, but just things to move your body. And by no means is movement a panacea or a cure-all for challenging emotions. But again, there's so much research that shows that in terms of things that most people can do and most people can do immediately, it is by far the most powerful. So I just encourage everybody to get moving. Force yourself to remember something that Steve and I say a lot. Mood follows action. You don't have to feel good to get going. You get going and then you feel good. So, you know, if you take one thing away from this podcast, I hope it's something on leadership. But if you take two things away from this podcast, please, please, please move, move, move. You'll feel better after.
You know, just to tie things together or end things, if there's one thing that we take out of this struggle, well, there's many things I hope we do, but one thing in related to exercise is I live right next to like one of the biggest parks in Houston, and it's been encouraging to see the amount of people just going for jogs or walks and mostly doing a good job of social distancing. But like, I hope that we keep that when we get through this pandemic, because I know we've, you know, here I talk about running, but we've gone on more walks now than I have in the last several years of my life, you know. And I think that it's a nice refresher that like moving, and it doesn't have to be thought of as exercise or whatever, but just getting outside and moving is beneficial.
Love it. So here's to movement, and hoping that that sticks around. Thanks everybody for listening. We will, we'll catch you next week. Again, we really appreciate all your feedback, so leave it.
Thanks for listening to the Growth Equation Podcast. Learn more about our work and find show notes at our website, www.thegrowtheq.com. Follow us on Twitter, at B. Stahlberg and at Steve Magnus. And if you like what you listen to, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, as this goes a long way in helping it reach others.